Welcome to Clause 8, the voice of IP, hosted by Eli Mazur. Is it preferable for patent cases to be handled by district court judges who have relevant expertise and experience? Senator Leahy can't make up his mind. The Leahy-Smith American Invents Act created the Patent Pilot Program. The program allowed federal district court judges in select districts to volunteer to handle patent cases. The goal was for certain judges to have increased expertise and, as a result, do a better job. However, last year, Leahy expressed outrage that Judge Alan Albright attracts a large portion of patent litigation to his Waco courtroom in the Western District of Texas. In a favorable reply to Leahy's pressure campaign, Supreme Court Justice John Roberts stressed, quote, the role of district judges as generalists, end quote. Eli decided to talk to one of the leading experts on the subject of patent venues, Professor Timothy Shea, about this recent controversy. Eli also talks to Professor Shea about how courts think about venues being outdated and his fascinating career trajectory as a patent litigator turned patent examiner turned law school professor. Clause 8 is part of IP Watchdog and sponsored by Harrity, the go-to firm for the Patent 300 for patent preparation and prosecution.
All right, so the first question that I like to start with is, do you remember when you first became aware of patents, and did you have any thoughts about the role they played?
Oh, that's a great question, because I sort of got into law, and my interest in law was sort of when I was thinking about applying to law school. It was almost like a last-minute thought or decision. You know, it wasn't really well thought through. And I was completing my engineering undergrad education at UC Berkeley. I was majoring in electrical engineering and computer science. And this was like the early 2000s. And so at the time, you know, I was very used to things that were like very, you know, concrete and tangible and, you know, hardware and circuits and things like that. And this whole concept of the law was just a very interesting, you know, concept or premise, because it was something that wasn't really tangible, wasn't really something that you could touch or feel or taste, but still controlled, you know, so much of our day-to-day interactions in society in general. And my dad, he was actually involved in this trade secret case. And so that was actually my first introduction to IP, like what intellectual property was. Yeah, because he was an electrical engineer. And the trade secret case he was involved in, you can actually find it like in the California Reporter. It's 103 Cal Reporter 2D, like I think 5-1 or something. And it's all about like sort of the definition of a trade secret.
Did you always have in mind that you wanted to become a law professor, or is that something you kind of decided later on in your career?
Yeah. So when I was in law school, I transferred to Hastings, and then, because, you know, my main sort of focus and goal was to work in California after graduating. Yeah. And I thought Hastings was like in the perfect location because Bay Area and Silicon Valley. And when I was in law school, I wasn't really thinking about it. But I knew, you know, like my best friend from law school, his name is John Haskell. He is actually a professor at the, I believe, University of Manchester in the UK. But he went straight from law school to academia, you know, and then he was like always interested in teaching, research and writing from the get-go, and really had no interest in like, you know, working at law firms or anything like that. And so like I was exposed to that, almost that like thinking, or that just, you know, going to the path of academia, you know, was something that was out there and possible. And then he also knew there was another mutual friend that we knew that I think he was his year. He knew better. I think his name was Boris. But he ended up also sharing that aspiration of just going into academia. But he went to law firms and worked there for a little bit just to pay off his student loans. And after he paid off his loans, then he went to academia. And so I was always exposed to that idea of like being a law professor and going to academia.
But most law professors, you know, are like your friends. They going out of law school, they know that's what they want to do, and they figure out, well, what's the path? Should I get a PhD? Should I do that?
Right.
But your experience is unique in that you practiced for a long time, and we'll talk about that a lot of different ways. Somebody out there who's listening to this who said, you know, that sounds pretty cool. What is it that you first did to actually start that process once you decided, I definitely want to do this? You know, like, what, where did you kind of begin in this after your long career?
Yeah, that's such an excellent question, because in many ways, my career has been backwards or like reverse, or I've done things like in reverse order with respect to the way, you know, maybe people traditionally do things, because I went straight to law firms, but usually people, like, especially if you want to get into patent law, patent prosecution or patent litigation, you like maybe work at the USPTO as a patent examiner and then maybe do a clerkship like an active patent district judge, or then maybe later on the federal circuit. But I, you know, went straight to law firms after I graduated from law school. And also, like, didn't really like, it was also another misconception about, I had about like clerkships and working in the federal government. I just thought like, oh, I just wanted to go straight to law firms and start making money. And for clerkships, I thought like, oh, they'd only, you know, the judges only select, you know, very top of the class. Like, I shouldn't even, it's just like a waste of time to even try to apply, which is not true at all. And it's one of those things where it's like purely a numbers game. And you actually, especially if you want to get into patent litigation, there's a lot of judges who look specifically for law school graduates that have that background, you know, and then it's just purely a numbers game. But anyway, I was just working at law firms. I was just working for law firms like for almost like close to a decade nonstop, you know, and sort of like, burnt out and just really just having such a narrow, laser focused drive at working at law firms and just billing hours and wanting to, you know, thinking to myself like, yeah, it'd be great if I could try to get a in-house job or go to into academia.
You mentioned your non-traditional history, and you actually ended up, you know, after your clerkship, you went to work for the USPTO as an examiner,
right?
Which before your academic career, which is similar to Albert Einstein's path, he was a patent examiner before
at the Swiss, right?
What motivated you to go work for the U.S. Patent Office as an examiner? Mm. What did you learn about the patent system from working there? How does the U.S. PTO do a job, you know, granting patents?
Absolutely, that's a really excellent question, because I would say, you know, the main motivating factor was I had such an incredible time doing my clerkship with Judge Payne that I wanted to do more. I just wanted to do more clerkships, first of all. And so after like my clerkship with Judge Payne, I was at like a IP litigation boutique in LA for a little bit, but I really wanted to do more clerkships. And so afterwards I was doing like sort of a judicial law fellowship or pro bono clerkship with Judge Michael Shipp in New Jersey. And then like, half a year clerkship with Judge Candace Westmore in the Northern District of California. She was another magistrate there in Oakland specifically. And I knew the career law clerk from law school, and she was out on maternity leave. And then, so they just needed a clerk to replace her for like the latter half of 2018. And so that was great too. I was able to see, you know, IndyCal and like historically, you know, very active patent litigation court, and even get a chance to talk to Judge Ronald White, who was sort of like the grandfather or the creator of the patent local rules, which is the subject of another paper of mine. But it was just like, I just really loved the experience of clerking and really getting a chance to sort of pull back the curtain and see how everything works. And I just learned so much from my clerkships that I wanted the same type of experience, but just for patent prosecution. Because for my the majority of my career, you know, I started out doing patent prosecution and just, you know, office action responses and drafting patent applications and doing all that. And then always just viewing the examiner as like just this, the, you know, the decision maker. But many times I just, you know, a lot of things I assumed, I thought like, oh, the examiner, like they must know every single piece of prior art out there, or the universe of everything. And so if I ask them to give me a hint, you know, they'll let me know. Or things like, you know, like I also thought that they had a lot of power. They could just say no. They would just say, I mean, like, even though you try so hard to like, you know, come up with some argument or even cite some cases, they'll just, you know, if it doesn't convince them, they'll just, you know, repeat the rejection. And I always found that so frustrating as a practitioner, because I thought like, I mean, come on, like, you know, this case is so on point, or like, you know, 101 at back at that point was hardly at the level it is now. It was just really easy to overcome 101. It was almost like a claim objection. You would just add a non-transitory or something, and then you would be done. But you know, 101, the 101 stuff I see now. But then, you know, like, if you didn't think their responses were persuasive, you would always try to appeal it. And then so I was always like curious, like, especially after my clerkships with judges, I was always curious, what's it like, you know, to be an examiner? Like, what's that perspective like, you know, is that really true? And, I wanted to understand, you know, like that, sort of the truth behind that power, you know, of being able to just say no, if you feel like an argument is really convincing. And so when I started as an examiner, I realized like several things. There were also misconceptions, like the fact that, you know, when I was a practitioner, I thought like, oh, they must know every single prior art out there. And then when I became an examiner, I realized no, that's not the case. Like, we don't know anything that's out there. And then it's always just like a search. You have to perform the search, right? And that became like you know, apparent immediately, the fact that there would always have to be like a you know, a further search performed. Or you know, I wasn't even aware of the search tools that were available, but we have, you know, we have a search tool at the USPTO for examiners, and it's sort of evolved over time. But I when I was a practitioner, I just thought like, oh, where do they find their stuff? Like on Google, or I just like, I didn't even know that there was like these, you know, databases. And so, and the same thing with like, you know, making arguments. So when I joined the PTO, I became part of the business methods art unit. And so that's like the 3600s. Part of the 3600s that are devoted to like radars, but the majority of 3600s is like, you know, anything.
So the just for the listeners, so the business method art units are notoriously the most difficult ones to get patents allowed.
Right.
And did you choose specifically to be in that art unit, or was that a...
No, yeah, it was interesting because I applied for the vacancy, and I guess they just assign you based on the need. And so I think like in the past, I might have applied and got an offer, and they assigned me to some like EE, like circuit unit. But the time that I applied and started in 2019, they assigned me to business methods. And I later learned that they like to hire lawyers mainly because of 101, and because like and business methods, in addition to being the, you know, the most difficult bar unit and having the lowest allowance rate, you know, one of the lowest allowance rates. And I remember there was this article by, I think Gene Quinn wrote it on IP Watchdog, about how to avoid the pit of despair known as 3600, and it was like an article saying just don't put the word money or fund or transactions in your claims, because it's true to a large extent, because if you do, like, it just triggers whoever is responsible for distributing the application to file it in business methods. But like, once it's filed in business methods, it's just like close to a death sentence, and the main reason is because of 101. And then I learned that you know, in my class of, we have like labs and classes, like more than 2/3 of my class were attorneys, and, they were either already practicing, already, you know, knowing the details of patent prosecution. But the main reason why they hired attorneys is really because of 101. And it was just like so much more sophisticated legal analysis, and, you know, citing Federal Circuit cases and really getting down into like, you know, what set of facts will overcome 101 and what really doesn't. And because when I was there, Iancu came up with the 2019 PEG, or practical examination guidelines, and that actually led to a lot of clarity. But the thing for it was just a point where before that, the examiners, many of whom did not have any legal background, were just like throwing one word case sites back to the attorney, and the attorney was trying to make legal arguments, and it just became an absolute like mess. And, you know, people were just like, the examiners were saying, yeah, like in BASCOM DDR and fish, and then just like not even citing the pages numbers or anything like that. And then
I mean, in their defense, I don't think the Federal Circuit could have done better.
Right. Yeah, that just adds, you know, so much more confusion, you know, because you can find 20 cases going one way, 20 cases going the other. But at the end of the day, you know, there's no clarification on how, you know, this specific technology claim should be allowable or not under 101.
During your training, that business method examiners are kind of trained to be more rigorous, or some might argue unreasonable, in terms of allowance, in terms of preventing cases from being allowed. Is that kind of the...
Yeah. I mean, especially for me, like I was, I think I was trained to be maybe overly rigorous at the beginning, you know, particularly because I came from, you know, I was a practitioner before. And so I sort of saw, but when I was a practitioner, I never prosecuted business method patents, and I only did, you know, focus on EE related technologies for the most part. And, but even if I did, anything with 101 back then, it was just so much easier, so much more simpler. It was, like I said before, it was really just like a claim objection. And then you would just add the word non-transitory, and then you would be done, and you would overcome the 101 rejection. But over time, you know, with like Alice and Mayo and, all those cases in Rebilski, it just has become just this really complicated morass of conflicting jurisprudence and, you know, like all these different Federal Circuit cases. And so now, you know, for like 102, 103, I feel like we're on the just the reasonable level in terms of like every other art unit, because like we have to find a prior art. But if they're, you know, if the applicants are able to amend their claims to a point where it really becomes, you know, not obvious if like I have to combine like three or four or five references. So that's probably like your standard level of difficulty. But I think the main roadblock is just 101.
Do you have any advice? Let's say you get a difficult examiner like yourself and you can't get a patent application allowed. What advice would you give to an applicant? Like what's any tricks, you know, that
yeah,
you suggest?
Yeah. You know, I would say, like, you know, my number one tip is always interview. And, you know, there's a lot of things that, like, if you just talk it out, and even, like, you know, a lot of times for, like, based on my experience, like, for 102, 103, talking it out is not that helpful, because it's really, like, you know, the examiner is always just going to say, well, I just have to perform further search. And,
yeah.
And as I learned, you know, like the examiner doesn't know the whole entire universe out there. Like they have to do that process of the further search. So it's really just like, it's not the most productive use of time to ask them like, oh, I added this new thing. Can you allow it? Like, I mean, it's just like, I need to take a look, you know, and then I need to do further search. But I think it's really helpful for 101, because then you get into the discussion of like, what is, if you do something or change something, you know, you really wanted to make it like a improvement to technology, or like an improvement to a technical field. And many times, you know, when I was just trying to talk to the examiners, I mean, trying to talk to applicants, I would say like, you want to make it very difficult for me as examiner to argue that, oh, this step is just can be performed by a human being, and all your hardware, all your, you know, the processors or whatever, just generic computing components. So if you take those out, you strip those out, and you're just left with abstract steps, you haven't gone enough, and you want to make it so there's a clear sort of like change in technology or improvement to technology. And so that would be my first tip, like always, you know, schedule an interview and always see if you can talk it out with, you know, the examiner. And if they're still like a junior one, there will always be a primary on the line as well. So they might have some ideas or maybe more like open to allowance or open to like brainstorming. Cause I have like, you know, one of the primaries that I work with, he came from a VC background, venture capital background. And so he's really gung-ho about like trying to brainstorm and collaborate and work with applicants, you know, to try to things they can incorporate, you know. But I've had other primaries that are like very, I would say like almost, they're like very jaded, you know, and sort of anti-applicant. So like they're not as open to, and it's really just, you know, very, really just depends. But I feel in my view, like because of like I just feel like, you know, they have this saying, we're the patent office, not the rejection office, and really the goal is to try to allow as much as you can. But the thing is, like, you have to really justify it. My second tip would be, like, especially for 101, I see this all the time. I always see, and this is related to the first point, but I always see all these, like, pages and pages of just, like, legal arguments and case sites and Berkheimer. And it just, that really is, like, not that persuasive, especially if you do it all the time. You know, and there's a high chance the examiner might just get annoyed and just have to like slog through all those legal arguments when you could just pick up the phone and call them and just try to talk to them.
Yeah.
And just make an amendment and then just save, you know, all that space.
That's great advice and mirrors my own about interviewing.
About interviewing, yeah. Exactly.
So I agree with all that. So I, you know, we talked about how you were clerking at Eastern District of Texas, and I'm guessing that's where you got your interest in patent venue as an academic subject. Interestingly, you wrote two articles about it, one of what has been published, one you're in the process. One you wrote both after T.C. Hartland, but one you wrote before Judge Albright became the Judge Albright we know today,
right.
And the other one you're writing now afterwards. So my first question, in that first article, you talk about, you know, how Delaware and the Northern District of California were going to become the two destinations, I guess, for patent cases, but if they weren't allowed to be in Texas. How have they performed since T.C. Hartland, do you think? Just for background, you said, here's a quote, due to the lack of resources, patent law expertise, patent trial court experience, and lack of a deep bench of judges, as in the case of Delaware, these courts might be ill-suited as transferee courts receiving the brunt of the nation's patent cases.
Yeah, no, that's an excellent point. I think when I wrote that, they had not yet appointed a new district judges to Delaware. I think they have, you know, Judge Combe Connolly and Noreika, and now they're a full bench. But at that time, it was like, I think they only had one active district. It was just like, they're a small court to begin with, but
yeah.
They had like, you know, two or three vacancies, which was really like, and they had to sort of rely on visiting judges. And I remember I even had like I had a clerkship interview with like the chief magistrate judge, Mary Pat Dinge. And I remember when I visited, like she was saying some like one part of the courthouse was like flooded or something. It was just like they had to deal with all these like challenges on top of, you know, these new cases, all these new cases coming in because of T.C. Hartland. But historically, they've always been a very active patent district court, you know, for the reason that you know of the fact that many companies incorporate in Delaware. And so that gives you instant venue. And so my time when I was also in practice, like at that one IP litigation boutique and also doing patent litigation, there was just and that IP litigation boutique represented more MPEs. And so for NDCal, a lot of MPEs just hated NDCal and just didn't want to file there because there was a much higher chance that the judges would grant one-on-one motions and just throw out their patents versus, you know, Judge Gilstrap requiring, he had this requirement of you had to submit a letter and then you had to go through all these extra requirements in order to basically even file a one-on-one motion. And then the chances of it being granted may not have been like skewed towards denial, but it was just harder to even lodge a one-on-one motion. So NDCal, like, but historically NDCal, because of it being in sort of like the hotspot where all the tech companies are, has been historically like a leader for patent litigation. But just the numbers are not as much as Eastern Texas or Western Texas. I think mainly because because there's another great paper by I think Brian Love and James Yoon, and they talk about like why do so many MPEs file in EDTechs, and it's really because there's all these really small procedural advantages that benefit plaintiffs. You know, most notably like the fast trial time, that's probably the most beneficial, but all these other, you know, little benefits that make it more attractive for plaintiff MPs to file. So the fact
another way to put that faster trial time is that the pet owners get their day in court, right? Versus some of these other districts where if you're talking about 10 years in some instances where it's,
And then just like the average federal judge in your average district, like they absolutely hate pen cases, you know, and they're going to take forever if they do end up trying one. But in ED Tech, it's like another week, another pen trial, you know, and then they've gone down to an art and a science. Same thing with Delaware too. And I think, you know, Judge Albright has that approach where, you know, they're able to do it extremely efficiently.
In the Western District of Texas,
In the Western District of Texas, And also, like, just if you look at the claim construction numbers of the judges that are there, like, you know, the top number, I think, is, like, in IndyCal is, like, it's definitely under 1,000, but it's, like, 600, 700. So that's considered, like, a lot, like, in IndyCal. But none of those judges are like in the top 10 because all the top judges who construe the most claim terms are in ED Tech, Delaware. And very impressively, Judge Albright was appointed, I think, in 2019, right? And within the course of like 1 or 2 years, he's up there now. He's one of the top, he's construed the most, some of the most like, in terms of like, he's like, I think, over close to 1,500 or something. But that's really impressive, like within the course of like 1 or 2 years. But Delaware, the numbers overall, like for claim construction, like just as a metric to sort of see like, oh, how many, not only how many patent cases you deal with, but how knowledgeable are you about, you know, claim construction and how many Markman hearings you do, which I think is more of an accurate indicator of how knowledgeable the judge really is. But if you look at, so for Delaware, the numbers were higher and you had like a lot of experienced patent judges do things. But my consensus from working in IP litigation firms was that Delaware is a lot more unpredictable. And there's a lot of judges who sort of like do interesting different things when they construe claims. Like, for example, retired district judge Greg Sleet, who I had a preliminary clerkship interview with. He would do something very interesting every time he drafted a Markman order, and he would like say the term was like a filter, and then he would say, oh, these following terms are being construed, and he would put a footnote, but in the footnote he would put paragraphs and paragraphs of his analysis. And so I don't know if that was a way just to say like, oh, this is not really part of the main holding, or I mean, he might have had like a brilliant reason behind it. I just don't know. But you had like each judge do very different things. But I just feel like the reputation that Delaware has in terms of like for the practitioners, especially if you're representing MPEs or plaintiffs, is that they tend to try to stay away from Delaware because there's less predictability and less certainty. Whereas if they file an ED Tech, you know, there's more consistency. And you get like more you can sort of expect what the result is based on prior precedent, which ideally, you know, for like any area of case law or jurisprudence, like usually that's something that is the goal for trying you're trying to attain, you know, some consistency.
I mean, predictability in law is, I think, something if you want to have rule of law, that's kind of a requirement, right?
Right.
We should look at that as a good thing, right?
I would think. Yeah, no, absolutely.
It's not just like a preference.
Right.
Be predictable or not.
Right. It's totally at the whim of, what the judge had for breakfast that day or something. Yeah. No, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. No, that, you know, I was going to say that's like, I try to make that like a consistent theme through both papers in that that's really ultimately good for patent law. And the fact that you know, a lot of people complain of like, oh, you know, there's this renegade district or whatever, and like all the people are filing there, but you know, ultimately if you're able to like get a stronger body of law, like more consistent decisions and rulings, and also decisions and rulings that are not challenged or, you know, even if they are challenged at the Federal Circuit maybe affirms them more often than not. I guess the exception to that would be sort of just the writs of mandamus. But aside from that, you know, just like any rulings on patent law concepts, and similar also to the PTAB, because there's so many PTAB IPR. I also, if you want to talk about I also clerk for Judge Jameson Lee, APJ at the PTAB. Yeah. And I remember going to this talk where they said that just on the maybe it's some procedural issue, there's more unpredictability about how the Federal Circuit is going to rule. But in terms of like the patent law issues, you know, like 102, 103, 101, it's like 70-80% of the time the PTAB decisions or the APJs are affirmed. And so I feel that is a sign that whatever lower court you're talking about, the PTAB or the district court, they're doing their job correctly, you know, and they're also making the correct decisions in terms of patent law, because, you know, if it's being affirmed by the Federal Circuit, it's something that is in line, you know, with the prior precedent. And as a result, you know, that body of law or patent law specific rulings coming from that court are more trustworthy than you know, say another court that has not had that level of experience or the number of cases. And you know, and then when you're looking at two courts that have a lot of cases, like ED Tex or Western Texas, and then Delaware, that predictability component becomes even more important, because you're sort of saying you want, you know, a body of law that is just consistent, you know, through and through. And that's ultimately, like, I feel the objective for, you know, for these district courts, especially district courts that deal with a lot of patent cases.
Putting the legal arguments aside and the legal precedents aside, I kind of want to talk about the concept of venue. After TC Heartland, you can sue a U.S.-based plaintiff in Delaware, where they're likely incorporated, or where they have a regular and established place of business. Do you have any thoughts about whether that concept itself is outdated? You know, you have these trillion-dollar tech companies that are literally make money by billions of dollars by being everywhere at all times, at least through the internet.
Right.
And yet, you can only sue them if they have a physical structure somewhere.
Right.
Do you have any thoughts about that? Is it like, you know, we're arguing about something that kind of,
yeah.
Why is that even an issue? But yeah.
Oh yeah, I agree with so much what you just said. It's just almost like it's one of those many examples where the law is lagging behind the technology, you know, and it just you know, the stuff from like Forco or from like years and years ago, the precedent that they're applying in the TC Heartland case is just like ancient. It's like about glass, you know, just sort of like this really basic technology. But I feel, yeah, it's just like one of those things where, like, you know, it makes Apple think and just say, oh, we don't want to store in, you know, close to Marshall, because that's going to be able to allow, you know, plaintiffs to sue us in East Texas.
Yeah.
And it just, I feel it is, yeah, the framework is really outdated. And if, especially because, yeah, Chief Justice Roberts mentioned that taking a look at venue in patent cases, or not only just venue overall, but also like when you're talking about filing a, in the case of, you know, Waco and Judge Albright, like specific divisions within the district court, like really trying to come up with, because I feel like at this point, it's something outside of the, you know, whatever Congress can do, they won't be able to sort of change that. So it might be something where it could be like a local rule or procedure or something that where it's more of like a regulation that governs where those filings happen. But I agree. And then, you know, through case law, too, they can sort of shape the application of, you know, the ultimate holding from TC Heartland. But I think, yeah, I really think like the regular established place of business and having to have like a physical, you know, brick and mortar location is extremely outdated. And, you know, nowadays too, especially we've, you know, through COVID and quarantine, everyone is sort of like working from home. And, you know, now that you can work from anywhere in the country, pretty much, that means that, you know, you are dealing with the technology. You can deal with the technology from anywhere in the country. And it just becomes like this whole notion of, you know, having to live somewhere just to commute or be based somewhere just because the company is there is now it's like, you know, considered like outdated, and we're just living like in, you know, a virtually connected world with the internet, and I think, you know, the any venue laws I think should be updated accordingly, and I agree too ultimately with that if there was any reform, because that allows, you know, the best courts that have that knowledge and have that expertise to hear those cases. And so and that's why in one paper I argue that the ED techs is the closest thing that we have to like a patent trial court that is, you know, not the PTAB, but something where if there is any like patent law, you know, like say the Federal Circuit just had like a trial court just dedicated to patent cases. And so like for that type of court, you would ideally want like the most experienced judges who've dealt with the most patent cases and have the most knowledge to create like this consistent body of law, very much like how, yeah, all the APJs hired at the PTAB also have significant patent law expertise and also technical backgrounds. And I feel, I feel like if the venue laws were changed to sort of allow this, allow filing anywhere, then you would, I think you would get a much more consistent body of patent law across the whole country, as opposed to, you know, sort of unpredictable, like rulings or, things that, you know, the Federal Circuit has to resolve based on jurisdiction.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's another interesting point that you made in that, paper is about, which I think seems self-evident. You want the judges who are handling cases to have experience handling it. I know, like, you know, whatever the cases the Southern District, District Court judges in the Southern District of New York handle, you know, maybe bankruptcy cases or big bankruptcy cases.
Right.
In the D.C. District, probably, you know, having to do with agency, federal government. They have a lot of experience with that. It seems to have flipped on its head when it came to the Western District of Texas, where you now hear the argument where, I haven't personally heard it before, where, no, we want the district court judges to be as generalist as possible. Mm. And the fact that one district court judge says he has experience in a certain area of law or too much experience is a bad thing. Is that just a talking point? How do you see that?
Right. No, that's really like one of these really controversial points. And I'm glad you brought it up because Paul Gagluza at Temple, he has this great paper too. I think it was titled like, you know, Federal Judge Seeks Patent Cases. And he did like a mock-up of, you know, like a Craigslist ad or something that was like, you know, Judge Albright just actively like trying to encourage filers in his court. And I think, you know, in that one, like later on in that article, he mentions that the patent law, like basically, like and you know, the concern before for T.C. Harlan was forum shopping, right? But he sort of frames the issue now with Judge Albright as judge shopping. So it's like you know, the parties, but I think there's nothing wrong with that because, you know, the parties want like the fairest shake possible and want, you know, the best judge that's going to give them the fairest result, that has the most knowledge and the most expertise in a certain area, you know. Right. And it's like, and I feel, you know, they're totally entitled to that. And just the fact that, you know, if you do file in Waco and you click that pull down, that drag down button, and Judge Albright's the only one there, but now they have, you know, they have Derek Gilliam, who's the new magistrate judge. So now there's probably some more diversity there. And I think it's, you know, I think it's a simple fix too, in terms of like, if you're so concerned about parties just trying to get one judge, just move more judges there, or just make it a way where, if it's only one judge in one division or one area, maybe like broaden the pool out to like areas in Austin or different divisions of Western District of Texas. But I really feel like, yeah, the judge shopping thing, you know, raises similar concerns as form shopping. But I feel, you know, I feel that I feel ultimately, you know, with respect to that argument that I try to make in that ED text paper, it's ultimately a good thing in my view, because you are allowing the parties, you know, to choose the best possible arbitrator of their dispute. And because it may be faster, you know, it might be slightly more attractive for plaintiffs, but that doesn't mean it's somehow unfairly skewed towards defendants. If anything, you know, the defendants are also getting a much fairer, much more balanced adjudication, because, you know, you have someone who's very knowledgeable about patent law.
Yeah, and plenty of defendants have won both in Eastern District.
Yeah, exactly. And yeah. That's a big misconception too, because a lot of people think like, yeah, if you're just a plaintiff, like you're just going to get a multi-million-dollar verdict. But they've done statistical analysis, and it's like it evens out, you know. And it's just like one of those, like,
yeah,
you know, if you drink the Kool-Aid or use it as a talking point, it's just very easy to like believe that one liner that, yeah, Eastern Texas is plaintiff friendly. But when you really look closer, it's a lot more complicated, and it's not as, you know, skewed towards one side. And it actually is quite the results. If you just look at the results, it's quite balanced.
The paper that you're writing now after Judge Albright is obviously a judge, you talk about the unprecedented trend of, and you mentioned that the Federal Circuit using mandamus orders to reverse venue transfers, which obviously they don't have the option not to get involved at all. What do you think is driving that kind of unprecedented behavior on the part of a Federal Circuit?
Yeah, that's a great question. And then Professor Gagliuzza at Temple has another paper about that. He wrote this paper around the time that the Federal Circuit was just using quite unusually a large number of writs of mandamus to challenge venue rulings coming out from the Eastern District of Texas. And in my view, I feel, yeah, a lot of those points he makes in that paper are essentially like, it's an extraordinary writ. You know, it's not supposed to be regularly granted and only used in the most like rarest of circumstances and for something extreme, right? So it's just highly unusual that, you know, there's like in the past year, I mean, in those years that he was analyzing, it was like 20 or 30, and they're all coming out from like, you know, the Eastern District of Texas, like in terms of venue transfer. And around that time, I feel that it was like a way to try to enforce TC Heartland without TC Heartland already, you know, being a U.S. Supreme Court case. And so after disposal, they just had limited, there wasn't too much they could do except for maybe doing a writ of mandamus, because it was almost like, because like, you know, the venue transfers happened so early on in the phase of a trial that, you know, like it's when you're trying to appeal, you know, motion for summary judgment, motion to dismiss, the case has already been disposed of. And you know, it's something that where the Federal Circuit would have to order a retrial or basically, you know, a new case. But I think because of the timeliness and sort of the urgency of having to rule on a venue transfer motion forced the hand of the Federal Circuit to use the writ of mandamus so often. And you see that a lot now, too, with the Judge Albright venue transfer decisions as well, because it's almost like it's just like he's constantly being second-guessed, too. And when I was in ED Text, I did quite a few of those orders involving venue transfer. And that paper really talks about how it doesn't need to be like eight factors or whatever. It's just really like, if you just boil it down to like, you know, three main factors or as little factors as possible. Because there was another great paper that Barn Barbie did at about like trademark. It was a similar like, he was just saying there's too many factor tests. And then like when a judge applies those, it's almost like they can try to short circuit the analysis, or it just ends up being sort of this arbitrary result where they can like, you know, choose one or two factors in their favor. But in the case, yeah, so like for both Western Texas and Eastern Texas, I think it's just one of those things that I feel the Federal Circuit has like is oftentimes left with no choice just to try to use it because it's there. And I think like if there may, you know, maybe to prevent it from being used less, you know, maybe require like raising the bar, you know, making it just like a lot more difficult to do a writ. And then, and because, you know, really it's something that you should, that the Federal Circuit should not, should really respect and not try to step on the toes of, in terms of, like, you know, the trial court's this discretion and trial court judges' decisions. And there was that great, it might have been a dissent, but it was like from Judge Moore in that Apple case where she said, you know, you really should be respecting whatever, you know, the trial judge is doing. And you can't just, like, launch these ad hominem attacks and, you know, try, right. you know, try to second guess them, because you're an appellate judge, you know, that's not your job. Like, their job is they're the expert, they're the master on all things trial related. So you really can't be, but it's sort of like, a little bit ironic, because I guess the, those are always appealed up to the, federal circuit. But, you know, something like venue transfer, that's totally within, you know, the scope and purview of what a trial court judge should be able to decide on their own, you know, without really any challenges. But oftentimes it's like you have the parties complaining, you know, the parties who don't want to be in Eastern Texas or West Texas, like they want to be in their, you know, home court, like Indy Cal.
When I read some of those Federal Circuit decisions about cases Judge Albright is handling, they seem somewhat hostile.
Oh, yeah.
Maybe over the top, right. I guess, in my view. And it's kind of like, I'm not sure how it benefits the system, even if they disagree with the ultimate decision, to kind of frame it in that way. Once again, I guess I want to, you know, there's an argument that it's not an area of our expertise, but the Federal Circuit is interpreting these precedents and so forth in a way maybe that's different from the way the Fifth Circuit would. Obviously, the bad cases from Judge Albright's courtroom, they go to Federal Circuit instead of a Fifth Circuit. And you have this dynamic now, which I find maybe possibly troublesome, where you have saying, no, cases shouldn't be tried in Texas. They should only be tried in Delaware or Northern District of California. It's not like they're sending them all over the place to most of the time, you know. It's not like they're going to a random district in the United States. I mean, does that present a problem of its own, do you view the fact that now you're concentrating all the cases? And
yeah, you're not really solving the problem. You're just like just trying to move it elsewhere. No, totally. Yeah, I feel like that's funny you raised the issue of senators too, because like there was sort of this conspiracy that this conspiracy theory that like a lot of the senators were trying to keep those cases in East Texas or I mean now West Texas, but East Texas for a while longer because, you know, it's a stimulus to the local economy and, you know, creates jobs and you have almost like this it's not tourism, but it's almost like just this constant influx, you know, of travelers. Yeah. And but I feel like I just don't really buy that, or just feel like you know, it's a boon. I mean, it's a benefit that like is nice to have as a result of you know, so much activity, so much people traveling into one area. But I just feel like why would it just seems to be so such a small benefit that like, you know, senators or lawmakers would, why would they try so hard to try to architect, you know, the venue law? And it wasn't really of their doing anyway. It was just the fact that the patent venue statutes were, you know, relaxed enough or just easy to, like, some lawyer's closet, you know, would count as venue, that it was just constantly exploited by, you know, the MPEs. And the MPEs are really the drivers of patent litigation. And so wherever the MPEs want to go, that's where you're going to find, you know, the majority of patent cases. And so that's why, as a result, Western Texas are top. But, you know, Delaware, like I said, the unpredictability factor, I think that factors into a lot of their preferences for not filing in Delaware. But they're, you know, it's very easy to get venue, so they file there anyway. But Indy Cal, you know, it just, they want to stay away from there as much as possible. But I think just one of those things where, like, where you're, if you just sort of like not solving the problem of, you know, venue, if you're not solving like that forum shopping issue and you're just sort of changing the forum, then that, you know, you might have like a new problem like that's created in that the forum wherever you sort of shift the cases to. But the key question is like, is that even a problem? What is sort of the concern that because I think like you know, in that letter that Senators Leahy and Tillis drafted,
yeah,
they were sort of concerned about you know, it's like the parties can just choose a judge or whatever. But you know, my arguments before from my papers was like, you know, is there really a problem with that? And you know, if that is such a big problem, like, you know, now there's a new magistrate judge there, and you can, you know, maybe like expand the Waco division to cover other divisions that would be, you know, that you just like draw the jury from, and maybe just try it in Austin. So I just feel like, you know, one of those, and I think like it's good that Chief Justice Roberts mentioned like wanting to do that full investigation and look at like really the issue of fairness, you know, for venue. Like, is there really a concern here? Or is it something where it's not really so much, you know, you're not getting like a particularly biased decision by having a case heard by a, like a very experienced patent judge. And I mean, to the contrary, I think you're getting a much more fair decision versus like if, you know, you were assigned to a judge who had like zero to no patent law expertise. And so that, you know, like you want to avoid that. And then I think the situation for getting a case before Judge Albright is something you actually want to encourage.
In that letter that you mentioned from Senator Leahy and Tillis, they make it seem kind of something improper about the fact that a judge is interested in
and
hearing a certain type of case.
Right.
And Senator Leahy, his beloved AIA, included the patent pilot program, which was designed to allow
right
district court judges to volunteer to hear patent cases. So I personally have to question if they're now kind of scrambling to find reasons why they think that Judge Albright is allowing patent cases to go to trial as improper somehow. At least that's how it seems to me, you know.
So. Yeah, I mean, it's sort of humorous because it's almost like, you know, it's almost like, you know, I just want to say for judges taking on patent cases, like it's that quote, like, oh, it's a dirty job, but someone's got to do it. Because the average, like I said before, like the average federal judge just absolutely hates patent cases, like with a passion, you know, like they don't want to. Because not only is there like a complicated layer of technology that you have to understand, there's also a complicated layer of like, you know, the procedures that are specific to patent law, you know, on top of that. So you have like almost like this, you know, double, like just this double layer of complexity that, you know, would judges absolutely hate. And then, and so if anything, I feel like a judge actively encouraging, not encouraging, but just making himself available to take those cases that the average federal judge hates should be encouraged, or even like he should be given resources that maybe like other very knowledgeable patent federal judges should be, you know, sent to his district or appointed near him, so that now instead of just you know, one judge, you have like sort of like this group of judges, and it's almost like then you have sort of a similar situation like how ED Techs has become over the years, where you have like just many judges in just different divisions, like, you know, not just Judge Gilstrap, but like Schrader. And now there's, you know, new judges in Tyler. But when I was clerking, there was a vacancy, previous Chief Judge Davis, he retired. So there was a district judge vacancy there for a while. But then the two magistrate judges there, Judge Mitchell and Judge Love, they were handling, you know, very active patent dockets too. So I feel like in that situation, you know, there was never that concern. You know, like its senators would not be writing letters about like, oh, there's all these. I mean, they were concerned about the patent venue form shopping, but the fact that there were so many, you know, very knowledgeable, very experienced judges being able to do that, to do like all the patent cases, I think is, you know, a good thing that the judicial system should strive towards.
Judge Albright, I also heard him say that everything he does is publicly available, so he's happy for any other district court judge out there in Hawaii or something to copy his rules, copy orders, and do what he does. And that would attract, I mean, there's no secret, you know, it's people file cases there, or pet owners file cases there because they think they'll have a chance to have a trial there. One last question I always like to end with is, you know, somebody's probably listening to this and he thinks, wow, that's a really cool career journey. What advice would you give to maybe a law student or maybe a very experienced patent attorney out there who's listening to this and he wants to become the next Professor Tim Shea?
The path is, it's really not easy, you know, and it was something that took me quite a while. And even though I had that aspiration or goal, it's just something that you have to constantly persist at and really just never give up and always like, you know, keep a small like spark alive. There was this like quote, I think from this author, Charles Bukowski, where he says like, always just keep like a small like fire burning. And that's really true for, you know, academia, because the path to getting a law professor job, it's highly competitive. And it's also one of those things that is very dependent on like so many factors that you just have no control over, you know, not just economy, but also like the law school's current financial situation, like if they want to expand, if they're like, you know, wanting to reduce their faculty, or they're looking for, you know, a certain faculty in a certain area. And the whole process, I feel too, is like one of those things that you have to just have you know, the knowledge of like what you need to do. And if anyone has any questions, like I want to encourage them to reach out to me. You know, like my main point of advice is really just like keep writing and try to keep publishing, because that's the main almost metric for tenure. And also when you, you know, as a professor, like just the work that you do is really mainly scholarship. Teaching too is one of those things that like you can learn on a job. But like if you show interest, or if you know, if you can somehow get like an adjunct teaching position, that's great. But I think a lot of law schools don't expect entry level professors to have that teaching experience already. It's mainly like you demonstrate that through like, you know, writing scholarship. You have to just like not get discouraged and just keep applying, keep trying to write and publish. If you can't get any teaching experience, that's also something that it would be great, you know, on your resume. But as I mentioned before, I think like that's really they evaluate you based on, you know, like your work experience, if you worked at firms or, you know, in the government or clerkships, and then also like your scholarship, and then like your ability to teach. And those are the three main, you know, the three main important factors. And so as much as you can do towards trying to, you know, strengthening those three things, you become more and more of an attractive candidate for law schools. And I would just say, just keep pushing and just keep applying. Oh, VAP positions too. That's another, like, a VAP is a visiting assistant professor position. And that's the main way to get around the fact that you don't have any teaching experience. Because if you apply for that program, law schools have VAPs. You basically get the chance to, like, do your research, but you really teach. And then after you do your VAP, you get to go back on the market now with that teaching experience, so you become much more attractive as a professor candidate.
Well, that's all great advice. Thank you so much for doing this.
Yo, thank you so much for having me on. I just feel so lucky and privileged, because I know like you've only truly made it if in the IP world, if you appear on your Clause 8 podcast. So I definitely feel very honored to be a guest.
Well, thank you. Thank you. I appreciate that. Thank you for listening to Clause 8. If you enjoyed this episode, please share it with others and leave a 5-star rating. I'd also like to thank my firm, Harity & Harity LLP, for their generous support. Clause 8 is produced by Great Feeling Studios and Brick Brewer. For more information, visit voiceofip.com. Thanks for listening.